Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first three meals free.
This is the Takeaway Podcast for December 15th, 2016. This is the Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. Early afternoon, local time in Aleppo, Syria, a line of as many as 30 green buses, all sporting the flag of Syria with the picture of a smiling Bashar al-Assad in the middle, slowly began to make their way into the crumbled and burning city of Aleppo. Tens of thousands of civilians and opposition military are to be evacuated at the end of a bloody siege where the city has now been retaken by government forces. These people will now begin a journey to the rest of their lives.
My journey started from Turkey. We crossed the Mediterranean with a plastic boat. It was 9 meters long and 3 meters close, and we were 65% in it, including 20 kids. And thanks God we didn't drown. We arrived to the island and we spent 3 days there, and then we got the paper which allows us to take a ferry. Then we took a bus from Athens to the borders of Macedonia. Then we arrived to Serbia. We went by train to the Hungarian borders. It was the worst part of the journey, so we were not so welcome there. They took us to jail. They put us in detention. They took us by bus to border city between Hungary and Austria, and they put us in a train. The train was completely for refugees, and they sent us to Munich. From Munich to camp, to a camp, another camp, another camp, and that's how my life is going right now.
The refugees in Aleppo are beginning a journey that young Basil Marshall began years ago. Thousands, millions like him, all in the rivers of humanity flowing out from the Middle East to find homes, or an unwelcome limbo in the worst refugee crisis since the end of World War II. Hear the voices of hate in Hungary pushing the refugees back in a changing, more fortress Europe that says, stay away.
He was a young man with a lot of dreams on his mind, trying to put everything together, live a happy life. He knew that there is something hiding in his country, but he loved it more than his soul, tried to protect it, no matter until he saw a demonstration.
Why has the world forgotten Syria? Basil cries out. He's lucky. He made it to Bergheim, Germany. Today he's a rapper who sings about his nation and his people. Has he found a new life? Partly. He awaits word each day of his family back in Syria, Al-Raqqa, the city where ISIS claims a new Islamic State is where most of them live. A large part of this hour we devote to Basil's life now and what is in his heart as he watches his home burn.
Hopeless. I mean, the Syrian war started in 2011 and now we're almost at 2017. Over 1 million person got killed. By many ways, it's not just with the Air Force, it's bombing, it's chemical weapons, it's slaughtering, it's burning. I don't know, and it really makes me feel so hopeless, because if something would change, it will change. But after all these years, I don't think nothing will change, because it's only getting worse. Believe me, it's only getting worse.
And for most of your life, as you were growing up, what did it mean to be Syrian compared with other places in the Middle East, compared with Saudi Arabia or Palestinian or Lebanese or some of the other nations? What did it mean to be Syrian?
I've always felt so proud and happy to be Syrian. I love everybody and respect everybody, no matter where they're from. I don't care about the nationalities, but you know, it's almost kind of something special to be Syrian, because Syria is known and all over Arabic countries. It's a very civilized country, and we have a lot of tourism places. And I was so happy and proud about it, and I'm still proud about being Syrian until now. But a lot of things changed. For example, I spent 1 year and 8 months in Turkey. And no one, I mean, you can say like 90% of Turkish people, they didn't respect Syrians. Why? Because I'm Arabic and I'm Syrian. That's the only reason. You can take a look, for example, at Syrian refugees in Lebanon. You can take a look there and see how a lot of Lebanese people are treating Syrians there. You can take a look at Syrians, for example, in Saudi Arabia. They make them pay a lot of taxes. Why? I mean, we already have our own war. We just want to live in peace. We don't want any luxurious life. I mean, the value of the Syrian went very low after the war. That's my point. The value of the Syrian human being went very low after this war. Because as you can see, Paris or Charlie Hebdo or Brussels, things happened. The whole world got crazy about it. I mean, why? We're not humans. It's only because we are Syrians. It's okay that we die. And those people, no, we have to support them and we have to pray for Paris or pray. We do. For me, I was sad and I was very sad about what happened there. But I mean, we're also humans and we also deserve some support. We also deserve to change your Facebook pictures for us.
So when people change their Facebook pictures to say, I am Charlie Hebdo or took the tricolors of the French flag, it made you feel just how left out you were as a Syrian.
Yeah, it made me feel like the world is looking at us like we are second quality human. I have this anger against anyone who could help and didn't do anything. And it's against anyone who was part of this, anyone who accepted this killing. Anyone who gives the green light to Bashar al-Assad to kill those people.
How worried are you about your family?
Well, I have my sister only in Syria and my mom in Turkey. My sister is married there in Syria. She's still there in Raqqa city. Yeah, she tried to go out, but those ISIS there, they don't allow anyone to leave their cities.
How can you live under ISIS? What's that like?
Well, it's hard, you know, because they want to rule by Sharia and all women have to cover from head to toes and all men have to release their beards and everybody should go to mosque and pray five times a day. And they don't allow anyone to watch TV. They don't allow anyone to use internet. Everything is expensive there. Like there's no bombing there, you know, there's not that much danger there, but it's a hard life, you know. The way they control people and the way they control people live, that's the hard thing.
Is there an answer to the question, why did this happen?
I don't know. A lot of people think that it's just normal revolution against a dictator. A normal civilian revolution against a dictator. A lot of people say it's like Islamic revolution to refresh the religion. Others say it's like a conspiracy theory. It's a conspiracy theory against the Syrian people.
What do you think?
For me, I think it's a revolution against a dictator. Because when we started, when I was going out to many demonstrations, by the way, and when we go out, I used to hold my hand with my Christian friend and my Kurdish friend, and we never thought that, okay, this guy is Christian or this guy is Kurdish or okay, I'm a Muslim, I shouldn't talk to those guys. No, we used to shout like Syrian people are one hand. That's what we shouted in our demonstrations. Syrian people are one hand, because we know that this revolution is all for all Syrians, no matter which group or religion they follow.
Do you think you'll ever live in that country, in that Syria, where Kurds and Christians and Muslims hold hands and speak in one voice?
I hope someday it will work, but I know it's going to take a lot of time. Because, you know, in my city, especially my city, it was so mixed. We used to live together, all together in peace and love in one hand. I mean, we used to marry Christians or we used to marry other groups, marry Kurds or the Shia or Alawi or whatever. We never thought about hating each other. But this regime is causing this hate.
How does it affect your art?
Well, first of all, I used to listen to rap music since I was 10 years old. And right now I'm 24. So it's been like 14 years, and since I was 14 or 15 years old, I don't remember, I was writing my rhymes, and when I was 17 or 18, I used to do freestyles, in the streets, but I never had the chance to record or do something official songs until I came here to Germany and found here a lot of brothers, real brothers, and they're my family here. They support me and they record and do the whole thing. But the war affected my rap, it make it more rebel, you know?
Who do you admire, the famous rappers that you used to listen to when you were 10?
Tupac.
What do you think Tupac would say about the situation in your country?
I think if Tupac had the chance, he will come to and fight against this regime, maybe. He will support us a lot, I know, and I'm sure about it.
What do you want people to think and to do if they are listening to your words and want to do something besides pray? What hope can you give them? I know you're hopeless, but...
Are we on air right now? I mean, there's a lot of people are hearing me.
Yeah.
I want everybody who can hear me, just do anything. Like, I'm not asking just come and fight against this regime, but for people who hate Arabs or for people who hate Muslims, for example, we're also human. I mean, we also have families. We also have feelings. We also got afraid when our houses got bombed on our heads. We also got afraid when we see our neighbors in another city getting choked to death by using chemical weapons. All what I'm asking about, and many Syrians are asking about, to all the American civilians or American politicians who have a little bit of humanity, because we didn't see anything of that humanity they're claiming they have. We just want them to take actions. Don't lose this chance. Because believe me, if the regime got control in Syria, believe me, it's going to be very bad for the whole Middle East, you can say, for Turkey. Or it's going to be bad also for Europe. It's going to be bad for many other countries. But we want from people just support us by anything, like to send helps to Aleppo, do some demonstrations in America against this regime. Do anything. Just ask Donald Trump. I know this man is useless. I know Donald Trump is useless. I know he won't do anything and he won't care about anything. I know that. And I'm not afraid to talk about it. But do just I'm asking from civilians, because we're also civilians and we feel each other. We know the government actions are nothing with our actions. Do demonstrations, go on in the streets, ask the politicians to do something to help Syrian people. We don't want to die. That's why we are forced to live, because we want to carry on in our lives.
Well, and you have to carry on, and that's the most important thing. Let me just ask you one thing to do after this conversation. And thanks so much for explaining and allowing me to feel so much of what's going on in your heart and in your country. I want you to get some rest.
No, I'm rested. Don't worry.
People are hearing you.
Well, for everybody who's hearing me, we just want to tell them that, just like what our African brothers in America said, all lives matter, Syrian lives matter.
You matter. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Basil Marshall, 24-year-old Syrian refugee now living in Germany, will leave you with more of his song called Story of a Refugee.
We should protect them and be for them a human shield. Some rebuild, they decided to face power with power, cause only power can take down a 40 years old dictator empire. They hold gun that clashed with the military, but he didn't join them cause he knows it's gonna be cemetery. The minority is running the show, decided to hit with a fist of armor.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, with a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving, training programs that draw from 50 brain games, and tools to compare scores with global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
Until the president-elect reassures us or takes significant steps to separate his business holdings from his powers as president, we will be asked to believe that a man who has made his career out of making big deals, trumpeting his net worth, stoking his public persona, will just put all of that aside and think only about something called the American people after he's inaugurated in January. President-elect Trump was scheduled to hold a news conference today to address his many business-related conflicts of interest, but that's been postponed. According to officials, part of the Trump team, he will address those issues in January before he's inaugurated. But can he?
Any one of his business interests would be a huge political scandal if discovered in the middle of another presidency. Take the former old post office, Trump International Hotel on Pennsylvania Avenue in Washington, D.C. Does Trump have to dump it? The Trump Organization's response on Twitter is that his sons will run the business and he will make no new deals while in office. Then there is Secretary of State nominee Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, who sanctioned oil development deals with Russia, could already be worth billions of dollars and billions more if the sanctions come off. Just to what degree are these conflicts from Trump and his cabinet already harming U.S. interests? And what are the consequences for a government that appears to be personally enriching itself through public service? It's a hard legal question, even for hardened cynics. Matthew T. Sanderson is an attorney for Kaplan and Drysdale and a Republican who has worked on the presidential campaigns of Senators John McCain, Rand Paul, and Governor Rick Perry.
In my mind, the only way to really handle this is to sell them to an outside party now. So, and that could involve either selling off individual assets, or more efficient would be to hold an initial public offering and basically put it on the stock market. And that way the public is able to buy and evaluate the company. And he would put the proceeds of selling all of his stock into a what's called a blind trust, where an independent trustee then has all of this money. And the trustee, independent of Mr. Trump, decides what to buy and sell. And so he would not have a picture into what kind of commercial interest he has on a regular basis. And that would divorce the government decision-making from the financial planning aspects of his personal finances.
Now, we should note that Trump has given absolutely no indication that he's willing to go this far, right?
That's right. So far, what he's saying is that he will turn over managerial responsibility to his children and to his executives. And he's calling this a blind trust, but it's just not credible to say that this is a blind trust.
He's their dad. I mean, they listen to their dad, and he's the boss, and he's the president. There's no blind there.
Yeah, it's a blind trust that is neither blind nor a trust. It doesn't do anything to solve his conflicts problem because, again, any favorable government decision, foreign government, domestic government agency, he would benefit personally. His net worth would go up anytime there's a favorable government decision.
Do you remember the era of Whitewater in the term of the of Bill Clinton in the 90s?
Yes.
And that was basically a land holding deal that supposedly was mixed up with government's favors and the possibility that Hillary and Bill Clinton would have been enriched by purchase of this land that they received on favorable terms. Nothing ever went anywhere with Whitewater, but it went forever and ever and ever. Is it the case that we are on day one of the Trump administration, we're like Whitewater times 1,000, and there's nothing even to investigate? It's all right there.
Right. Yeah, that's exactly right. And so he has a decision to make. Does he want to deal with these stories throughout his presidency, or does he want to, quote, make America great again? Does he want to pursue his agenda? Because this will become a significant drag on his presidency overall. And, these are legitimate stories. I'm a Republican lawyer. There are Republicans out there talking about this. There are people of all political stripes talking about this. And you can't in one breath say that the Clintons, that Hillary Clinton didn't deserve to be elected because she was so conflicted because of the Clinton Foundation or because of Whitewater, because of other similar deals. And then in the next breath, pursue all sorts of business deals with foreign governments or pursue business deals with shady partners that will inevitably result in scandal. And so he just has to decide whether he wants to treat the presidency as a full-time job and whether he wants to actually pursue his agenda. If he doesn't treat this in a serious way, this will haunt him for the next 4 years.
Finally, Rex Tillerson, the CEO of ExxonMobil, who's the designate for Secretary of State, there's a half-trillion-dollar Arctic oil deal stuck in sanctions. Does the outcome of that become a conflict of interest for a Secretary of State? Is there any way to insulate either Rex Tillerson, Exxon, or the Trump Organization from the benefits of that?
Well, I think Tillerson's in a little bit he's in a complicated situation, but it's a little bit different and a little bit more manageable because he does hold currently Exxon stock and some options. But, you know, Exxon is a publicly traded company. So before he takes office, before he becomes the Secretary of State, he can sell those off. There's obviously a public market for that, and that would resolve the conflict. But this kind of gets back to, I think, what has become a complicated situation, because you not only have the president-elect who has a very complex conflict of interest, but you also have Tillerson and Ross and DeVos and McMahon and Ricketts, and the list goes on and on of extremely high net worth individuals. That's why this is such a complex situation. Usually you only have one of these people, one or two high net worth individuals who are in high level positions in government. This is an unprecedented challenge.
Matthew Sanderson is a Republican attorney for Kaplan and Drysdale. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C. Thank you, Matthew.
Good to be with you.
Federal authorities are now looking at whether a seemingly state-imposed 8.5% rate of enrollment for special ed students in Texas makes any sense. Parents of children with special needs are used to fighting for their children to get the services they're entitled to under the Americans with Disabilities Act and other federal education requirements. But this ceiling in Texas may be unique. Texas has the lowest rate of children in special education of any state. It's continued to stay that way, even as the student population has swelled. An investigation by the Houston Chronicle alleges state and local school officials have intentionally kept the enrollment rate low. Bill Zeeble has reported on this issue for KERA in North Texas. Bill, welcome to The Takeaway. What's this investigation say?
The investigation, the Houston Chronicle investigation said that the Texas Education Agency, since 2004, put a cap at 8.5% of enrollment for special education children. So districts across the state, more than 1,000 of them, figured, oh, we better not enroll more than 8.5% of our student population, or else the TEA might crack down on us and start investigating and auditing our budget. So let's cap it at 8.5%. And so you have districts like Dallas under 8% and some other North Texas districts under 8% when the national average is in the range of 13%.
And for parents who are used to getting services that they need, if they can demonstrate that they have those needs, this completely upends the table.
Oh, we heard from a lot of really, really, really upset parents because the Department of Education came in and in five cities said, we want to hear from everybody trying to get or having gotten received or received services. Cindy Wilkerson, who has several adopted kids, explained how really, really bothered and upset she was by this apparent cap on special education.
This is out of control. You're going to expect them to pass a test, a state test, but you're not going to give them services. Guess what happens to the kid? For most kids, medication. They're on so much medication, my kids were. I took them off. It was like having a bunch of drug addicts.
So what do employees and the special ed teachers think about all of this?
Some employees are outraged. We heard from several who worked in Dallas. Others defended the program, saying parents may not understand what the process is. We never got into this job to deny services to children and especially to special education kids. But then we heard from Daphne LaMontagne, who's a Section 504 coordinator. She had been with the Dallas School District before she left. And she said, no, what you're hearing from these parents who are upset, I've seen it.
When a parent says, I want special education testing, they did not want that to trigger in the system. They wanted to slow that process down. And I watched it over and over and over. Again, to the point that I couldn't stay and be a part of that system, knowing that at some point they were going to get caught. And I did not want to be sitting at the table as someone who had knowledge of this, who stayed and perpetuated the issue.
That was a pretty devastating accusation, which the Dallas School District has denied, although the Dallas School District, when I talked to them yesterday, said, oh, well, we heard some issues. We're looking into this.
Will this be resolved federally, Bill, or will it be resolved in the school district sooner rather than later?
Well, there's an investigation by the Department of Education, which they call a review. when a result from that review will occur, it isn't clear. But they did address the Texas Education Agency. The TEA said, we haven't denied, but we may change some of our procedures so that this 8.5% cap, which they say is not a cap, will not be misunderstood by school districts.
Bill Zeeble is a reporter for KERA in North Texas. Thanks so much, Bill.
Good talking to you.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
For only the second time in a decade, and with the stock market on fire as a backdrop, the Federal Reserve decided yesterday to raise interest rates. The chairwoman of the Fed, Janet Yellen, announced that the rates will increase by 0.25%. Job growth, rising inflation, consumer spending gave Fed officials the confidence to make such a move. They also forecast a positive economic outlook and, as much as promised, three additional increases over the course of 2017, and that may be the surprise in this news. It's the first time the Fed has met since the election of Donald Trump, who has called for tax cuts and increased spending. Charlie Herman is business and culture editor for our partner WNYC. Welcome back.
Hello.
So we've really turned the corner now. We are now looking at rising interest rates, even at this small increment.
I think so. I mean, they have made this clear that they want to do this. Everyone thought that they were going to do two interest rate increases next year, and now they've said that they're going to do three. And in a way, we have been waiting for this moment when the Federal Reserve would, you know, lift off, when they would try and get back to normalization after the financial recession of 2008. And I think we're starting to see that now. They are slowly trying to get back there. These are very small increases. You know, right now we're at 0.75% thereabout for this key interest rate. A year from now, if all goes as they're describing, we could be about 1.5%. That's not a huge increase, especially when you consider rates in the past have been up around 3 or 4%.
But it will have an impact almost immediately on mortgage rates. Not huge, but it will have an impact.
It can have an impact. I mean, there sometimes is that connection and follow through that when you see this interest rate change, you'll see a change in those rates. Mortgages are often going to follow what's happening with the treasuries, U.S. treasuries, 10-year treasuries. And that's kind of been fluctuating a lot. And in some aspects, those will be related more to the perceived sense of what happens in a Trump administration. Is the economy growing really well? So maybe we want to take our money out of bonds, out of treasuries, and put it in the stock market. But one thing that will change pretty quickly probably, and we've seen this already, is your credit card interest rate, because a lot of banks will set your rate based on the Federal Reserve rate. They have a prime rate, and we did see some banks yesterday actually increase that slightly. Mm-hmm. So if you're trying to pay off your credit card debt, pay it off faster, because the more this rate increase, the higher your interest rate could be.
I can't imagine two more different personalities than Janet Yellen and Donald Trump. And I thought it was really interesting that at a time when there's so much uncertainty about what's going to happen post-inauguration, her message was as though we've been on the most tranquil course for the last 12 months. I mean, she expressed a lot of confidence in this economic growth. She thinks it's going to continue. Didn't register anything specific about the Trump administration.
Yeah, I mean, she said that, you know, we're operating under a cloud of uncertainty at the moment. Mm-hmm. And I think they're really taking this wait-and-see approach. We, you know, the president-elect has talked about tax cuts and talked about infrastructure spending, but the Fed is trying to base their predictions on what they actually know right now. And we don't know exactly what that would be. And what she sort of made clear was is that we're going to have this wait-and-see approach. If huge tax cuts are put through, then the Fed would obviously change their outlook, and that may affect the number of interest rates that they do. But I think she was definitely trying to put out there this sense of we want to see what happens. I will say one thing that was interesting is on this question of fiscal stimulus. This would be, you know, big congressional spending right. programs. You know, she did kind of hint that, you know, that often you would do that to give job growth. You know, you have high unemployment, so the government spends a lot of money, and that would get people jobs. And, you know, she said that really we don't need that right now because unemployment is so low at 4.6%. There's this sense that, yes, there are a lot of people who have dropped out of the workforce that could come back in. But unemployment is low. This is to stimulate the economy just to get jobs created. You know, what we have is nationwide, of course, a low unemployment rate, and fiscal stimulus may not be the right way to go about doing that.
Yeah, she didn't say it was a bad idea, but she said we're going to get there anyway.
Yeah.
We're going to get there anyway. And so it sort of was, you know, not necessarily what we would want to see right now.
Exactly.
In terms of a third interest rate rise in 2017, is that a big surprise?
That one was, because people thought it was going to be two, and they said, no, we're going to do probably three. But I think predictions are hard. They have, you know, a year ago, previous years, they predicted they would do more increases, and when economic conditions changed, they didn't.
Charlie Herman, business and culture editor for our partner WNYC. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Yahoo! So is every Yahoo a yokel now? The Yahoo brand took another hit this week, as the company revealed yesterday. It said over a billion user accounts were hacked in 2013. Now, in the annual report to stockholders of that year, Yahoo CEO Marissa Mayer was more enthusiastic about the company passing 800 million monthly active users. But that's a lot of hacks. Here's a figure for you. For every seven people in the world, there's most likely one with a hacked Yahoo account. The billion compromised accounts are separate from a hack affecting 500 million user accounts in 2014. So that's a billion and a half, which Yahoo disclosed this past summer. With more, Kim Zetter, journalist and author covering cybersecurity for more than a decade for Wired, Washington Post, and The Intercept. You got a Yahoo account, Kim?
I'm not saying.
That's right. Don't say. Yahoo equals hacked at this point?
Possibly. I mean, you know, the billion number is a little deceptive because a lot of people use Yahoo accounts for throwaway accounts. So it might be, you know, one person has 5-10 Yahoo accounts, and many of those might not be very active. I know Yahoo announced in 2013 they had 800 million active accounts. But again, many of those may be multiple accounts for a single person. So that doesn't indicate, you know, a billion users are affected.
In terms of consumer cybersecurity, is there anything about Yahoo that makes it a compromise, a technological compromise compared to other places?
Yeah, so we don't know exactly. Yahoo apparently doesn't know how this breach occurred. They said that in their announcement, that they're not really quite sure how the attackers got this data. Every company is sort of susceptible to this, especially, you know, they're like banks, that if they've got a lot of accounts, then they are going to be targets for data breaches like this. What makes this particularly egregious for Yahoo is, of course, as you mentioned, that they had another announcement in September about 500 million accounts, and they're saying that this breach seems to be separate from that one. So these are sort of, you know, serial attacks on Yahoo, and they don't seem to be getting the security right.
In terms of forensics here, how do you investigate what happens in a follow-on to a hack like this? So let's just say somebody or some agency gets a billion files or 500 million files. You would tend to see from that a systematic use of 10,000 of those files to try to get money, or, you know, you'd see a kind of pattern in the way in which that data was used that would point to some particular hacking modality or, you know, hacker style. Anything like that going on?
Well, I think the way that this was discovered is that the sale of the data was discovered in the dark market and underground forums. So that's usually the first indication. And sometimes if you can catch it when the sale is happening early, then you can actually prevent that fraudulent activity that you're talking about. So you may not discover it through fraudulent activity accounts. You may discover it during the initial sale. The thing is with these accounts is that even though, you know, you're talking about a bulk amount of accounts like this, they're not necessarily using the data to get into the accounts. This data was being sold to spammers in large part. So it was discovered being sold in the underground market to three different buyers. Two of them were known spammers. So you wouldn't notice fraudulent activity getting into the accounts, but you would notice, you know, increased spam. The third buyer was interesting, though. This is coming from a Bloomberg story. The third buyer seemed to be an intelligence agency or nation state, because when they were looking at purchasing this data, they asked the seller, they gave them a list of 10 names of U.S. government officials and company officials, and asked them if they were among the data. And so that indicates that someone may have been looking for targeted accounts in that case. So again, you're not going to see sort of bulk fraudulent activity. You're going to see spamming and maybe targeted fraudulent activity.
So tell me about these dark auctions for lists. Where do they occur? How do you authenticate a good list? And if you have a good list, you know, where do you go to peddle it?
So there are these underground criminal markets. I call them underground simply because they're not accessible through like a Google search. They're hosted by what's called the Tor Onion services. And that means that you need to know the specific Onion email address in order to get to it. And oftentimes they may be protected in other ways as well. But anyways, these are forums, like just like any sort of e-commerce market. You can go onto these sites and you'll see hackers selling stolen goods and services. And you can contact them if you want to sort of test the data to see if it's accurate. They may give you a sample of Yahoo addresses and passwords if they have them. And you can test to see if you can actually get into those. Same thing with credit cards. When they sell credit card numbers in bulk, they may give you a sample of credit card numbers so that you can test them to see if they're still live numbers.
If I wanted to buy a list of 10,000 credit card numbers that I would expect a yield of, say, 70% of them were good, how much would that cost?
You know, it really depends. It fluctuates. The sale of card data used to be, I mean, it depends on the card data as well. If we're talking about, you know, just a Visa card number, or if you're talking about sort of a black card,
right,
of American Express. And it also depends on what are the balance limits or the charge limits on the cards. So, you know, a sale of cards can go anywhere from $1 per card to up to $20, depending on the cards,
amazing,
the value of the cards.
Kim Zetter, journalist and author covering cybersecurity for Wired, The Washington Post, The Intercept, and other publications. Thanks so much, Kim.
You're welcome.
Like to take a cement fix, biggest standing cinema. Dress my friends up just for show, see them as they really are.
Sometime around 1971, an inspiration became an art form, and eventually became a musical genre. David Bowie and the song Andy Warhol articulated what would become the rock music art stage of the 1970s. The movement called glam rock took the celebrity of rock and roll and fused it with the experimentation of freeform expressionist art.
Holly came from Miami, FLA, hitchhiked away across USA, plucked her eyebrows on the way, shaved her legs, and then he was a she. She says, hey babe, take a walk on the wild side.
Glam was where gender stopped and a space-age androgyny began, where artist Lou Reed could work out his bisexuality on stage, something as a teenager he'd received shock therapy for. Musicians, artists, and fans flocked to the short-lived glam scene, which became the stripped-down and angrier punk sound in the sober era of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan's 1980s.
Dance myself right at the
womb. T-Rex, heard there playing Cosmic Dancer. New York Dolls, Alice Cooper, Roxy Music were among the standout bands. They are all featured in Simon Reynolds' comprehensive Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy, from the 70s to the 21st century.
Glam is like, starts really around 71, 72, and the phase before that was this sort of all dressed down, all grown up sort of phase of rock where, you know, everyone has beards and they're talking about grown up stuff and it's album oriented. And you're supposed to sort of sit reverently and contemplate the music for its deep, profound meanings. And the sort of teenage fun aspect of it went away. And so glam was very much about singles, about danceable, rock and roll was danceable, and it was about something visual.
We passed up on the stair. We spoke of was and when.
Bowie and Alice Cooper both wore man dresses, you know, on the album cover of The Man Who Sold the World. Bowie looks very fetching in this sort of frock, and he's reclining on a chaise longue, looking very feminine. Alice Cooper wore this sort of strange little green frock on this album, Pretty for You, where the effect is more grotesque, because he wasn't as exquisitely gorgeous as Bowie.
Gorgeous as Bowie, yeah, that's right.
But, you know, he played it more for a kind of weird freak sort of thing.
He certainly got the effect that he wanted, but it just takes me back to how outrageous that was.
Yes, nowadays you wouldn't blink an eye.
No.
But it was definitely, you know, in some ways Mick Jagger was a pioneer of glam. I think he was wearing makeup. He wore a man dress at this famous Hyde Park concert in London. And Bowie kind of had this weird thing where he wanted to, you know, be more shocking than Jagger. He had a kind of friendly rivalry with him, and he felt the Rolling Stones had been the outer limit of seditious, subversive sexuality and rock presentation in the 60s. And how'd you go further? Well, you say you're gay. He famously said, I'm gay and I always have been. Seems to have been a bit of exaggeration, but as a quote that sort of kick-started his career, it had a huge reverberation. And it was liberating. It was liberating for gay people in the 70s who didn't have a pop star they could identify with. It was liberating for a lot of sort of straight guys who liked the idea of perhaps they were a bit more fluid sexually than they realised. And, oh, I'm kind of attracted to Bowie. He's very pretty. So that, you know, that's one side of it. And then the other side of it is more groups that play it for laughs, like The Sweet and Slade.
Every day when I'm away, I'm thinking of you. Everyone can carry on except for we two.
Where they're kind of dressed up almost like a pantomime, cross-dressing, you know, it's more like absurdist glamour.
All of a sudden, it's the rock world that's beginning to embrace the visual arts, and even visual artists are coming into the fray.
Definitely, and then also, actually, you mentioned opera. Queen were a band who were considered early on to be sort of aligned with glam, and with Bohemian Rhapsody, they literally are using opera techniques, but they're using them in the studio. Like, so they're multi-tracking voices. I think there's 180 voices layered in Bohemian Rhapsody.
Bismillah, no, we will not let you go.
Let him go.
Bismillah, we will not let you go.
Let him go.
This way, you're sort of like hyper opera, is what I call it. Like a studio, it's like way beyond what could be done on the stage with opera. In the book, I sort of punningly describe Queen as Baroque and roll. Like their aesthetic is Baroque. You know, it's very ornamented and layered and sumptuous. And it's regal. You know, they call themselves Queen for a reason. You know, they were into this pomp and ceremony.
Did Freddie Mercury ever speak about how seriously he took this? Or was it just sort of, that's my job, I'm rock and roll?
Well, he loved the idea of being a dandy, of being very theatrical, being a diva, really, you know, a rock and roll diva. And decadence was a real buzzword in the 70s, and for some people it was like, we aspire to be decadent. What a lovely idea. The world is ending, everything, the 70s is going to hell in a handbasket. Let's just have fun and be merry while we can. Then other people were writing like serious newspaper columns like, is our culture decadent, you know, is Western civilization going down the tubes, you know. So it was a sort of, it was a buzzword. It was something to aspire to, a sort of fun, chic idea of decay and dissolute behavior, but also something people genuinely were concerned about.
Did the AIDS crisis in some ways end the glam movement or decimate the glam world?
It took out some of the performers, but I think glam had kind of ended in the 70s with punk. You know, glam was all about fantasy and escape, you know, and creating fictional characters like Ziggy Stardust. And in many ways, just people like Mark Bolan on stage was a fantasy creature, you know. He was obsessed with Tolkien and the idea of himself as a kind of wizard or an elf. It was all about fantasy and escape. And then punk kind of took it back to the street and street realities and kids, you know, the problems of teenagers with no jobs. That kind of sort of grim reality kind of came into
Maggie Thatcher.
Yeah, exactly. Maggie Thatcher. And just, you know, it got a lot more serious. There's more substance to punk. A lot of musical things in common, though. A lot of glam and glitter groups like The Sweet kind of anticipate the punchy, aggressive sound of punk.
What fantasy did you most embrace in glam as a fan or even as a distant fan?
You know, there's this phrase in the Rocky Horror Show, which I think, along with Cabaret, is like the Rocky Horror Picture Show is a glam movie in lots of ways, where Dr. Frankenfurter says,
"Don't dream it, be it."
And it's just that sort of the glam ethos in a nutshell is you can reinvent yourself. You can be a superhero.
Be it. Don't dream it.
Simon Reynolds is a music journalist and author of Shock and Awe, Glam Rock and Its Legacy from the 70s to the 21st Century. Thanks so much, Simon.
Thank you.
My name's Christian Moes. I'm calling from St. Paul, Minnesota. I was actually just hoping somebody could get back in contact with me. I love the music segments in between your stories and wasn't able to figure out what they were, what bands they were.
Hey, Christian, I think we can arrange that. The song we're playing right now is called The Rocket by a wonderful band called Wintergarten. But if you ever want to know what we're playing, hit us up on Twitter, at The Takeaway. We'll let you know. Also, got a suggestion for something we should play in the future? Got some of your music you want to hear? It's your show. Don't hesitate to call us at 8778-MY-TAKE or hit us up on Facebook. That's our show for today, folks. One more this week, and we'll see you tomorrow. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.